And I'm delighted to introduce, and thank you for being here, Tim Farron, MP.
Thank you for having me.
It's fantastic. So, Tim, the MP for Westmorland and Lonsdale, which is where you go on holiday, and married to Rosie with four kids, Izzy, Gracie, Jude, and Laurie. We're very grateful you're here. We kept expecting that something might happen to cancel tonight, but we've just heard about a resignation, but...
Not yet to the Prime Minister. So yeah. If you're not following... I've literally put my phone on airplane mode, A, because it's rude not to, and B, because it'll interfere with the equipment. But Andrea Leadsom has just resigned. Who knows what happens next, eh? So we're about to talk about something even more important than that, though, aren't we?
That's right.
And not me, by the way.
There's an election tomorrow, and you fly up at 4 a.m. tomorrow to...
We don't fly until late. I'm on the train at some ridiculous hour because the sleeper was fully booked, so I'm on the 5:30 in the morning to go and knock on doors in Kendal because that's what you do on election day.
That's right. And I'm not sure if we're covered by pre-election rules here. I don't know if you're allowed to canvass or...
Well, I won't because we're talking about, as I said, something even more important.
We will start... just with politics a little bit. You are a Bible-believing Christian who is a politician but is not right-wing. Is that possible? Is that...
Well, all those things are true, so they must be possible. I think left-right is a little bit restrictive and doesn't explain the full range of opinions, but I'm a centre-left liberal and a committed Orthodox Christian. A Bible-believing Christian, and I don't think that if you are a Christian you have to be a centre-left liberal, but you can be. And I think if you go back in time, the Liberal Party in this country, its greatest leader was not me. It was William Ewart Gladstone, who was a committed evangelical Christian. The liberal movement in this country came out of the nonconformist, we'd call it today, evangelical Christian churches who fought for equality and religious liberty, not just on their own behalf, on behalf of other faith, and indeed those who held no active faith whatsoever. And indeed, the clamour for equality, for social justice, almost always came from a Christian perspective in this country and elsewhere in the Western world. It's only really in the last, let's say, 30 years there's been an assumption that to be a committed Christian means you must be of the right. You can be of the right. Of course you can.
You have friends.
I do have actual friends who are in the Conservative Party and indeed Christian friends are in the Conservative Party and in the SNP and in the Labour Party and in my own party as well. I think that so there are some political persuasions at the very, very far extremes. I would strongly counsel a Christian sister or brother not to get involved with. However, I think otherwise, making a choice to get involved in politics is a good way to serve. There isn't a definitive political position on the spectrum that you need to hold if you are a Christian, but you can legitimately be a centre-left liberal and a committed Christian.
Let's go to your decision to get involved in politics, which was before you made a decision to be a Christian. You joined the party at 16.
I did
join.
Right?
Grew up in Preston, joined the party at 16.
Yep.
You were standing to be an MP at 20. Is that right?
I was still 21. And as any of you who were bothered watching the statement today might know, I Theresa May and I fought one another and both lost. I missed out by a mere 20,000. I was up in Newcastle.
That was which election?
It was the 1992 general election. I was about a few weeks short of my 22nd birthday. So I was 21, which was the youngest you could be in Stanford Parliament there. I just flew the flag. I was at university in Newcastle. So in the days before mobile phones, the house phone went. And my friend John picked it up and chatted up and said, "Tim, there's a woman on the phone to you." I said, "A girl?" And she said, "No, it's definitely a woman." And it was a lovely lady called Frances, who was in her 70s, who was the secretary of the regional Lib Dems, said, "Look, we're desperate for candidates in places we can't win," brackets, that's most of them. And I ended up with Northwest Durham. And so Theresa May and I were on the same ballot paper as the very impressive Hillary Armstrong, who was Tony Blair's chief whip for for the whole duration of his premiership and was duly elected and returned in 92. But I joined the Liberals in September 1986, which is my first month of being at sixth form college.
Slightly intense. I was told that when you're interviewing, it's good to try and build a rapport. So I've just
go on.
I brought with me, and I think it's going to come up on the screen, just...
That's a 92 election.
That is a 1992 my election vote. Poster with my name on it.
There you go.
So, and I,
marvellous.
So I joined the party at 16, as all weird. I hadn't told you this in advance, had I?
This is pretty exciting.
But I have to say, I only did it to try and win a school election.
Right,
so
okay.
So the Lib Dems in town said they'd print me posters, hundreds of posters, if
that
I joined.
That is marvellous.
So they did.
There you are.
But,
well,
but there you go.
So they're
that's
better than mine.
To make you feel
so
at home.
They're much better posters than I had.
And, oh, really? Okay,
so
there you go.
Mine were literally made by Letraset and on a photocopier, but... But yeah, so I...
Why get involved in politics? Why join the party at 16?
So
you probably had a better reason than me.
I don't know, really. I mean, I'd become politicised. There's two things. I mean, there's more to it than this, really. I guess I had a mum who was politically interested but not active, and so we were encouraged. You know, we had the... she used to refer to herself as the nouveau poor. So nouveau riche, no class and loads of cash. My mum was the exact opposite. So the Guardian reading, sort of middle-class aspirations and no money. But we had the Guardian delivered every day. And so that was I was aware of, politics through all that. And my mum's politics were probably, Liberal SDP Alliance versus Labour. Never quite sure how she voted back in those days. Two things, though, really. Thing one, there were two major televisual events back in those days when there were only four channels, kids. So television had a great impact on me. The two major television events every week would be that everybody watched Thursday night Top of the Pops. Friday morning, everybody talked about what was on Top of the Pops the previous night. Sunday night, Spitting Image. Which was, if you weren't aware, was the sort of the latex puppet caricatures of British politicians at the time.
And so that made you think, I've got to be one of those.
And sadly, it was cancelled before I came along, but never mind. But I think the point is it made people talk about politics as a soap opera. Kids who had no interest in politics at all knew who Neil Kinnock, Margaret Thatcher, David Steele, Michael Heseltine were because they'd seen them on the Sunday night. So there was a general awareness of politics. But the thing that actually, I think, politicised me was another thing that I watched on account of the fact there was nothing else on the box. And one night, I don't know much more than the fact that I was in the living room on my own, and a film came on, a repeat of a famous film called Kathy Come Home, which was, of course, made by Ken Loach, and who made I, Daniel Blake. But this film was made in 1966. I watched it in 1984. And if you don't know it, very quickly, Kathy and Reg are a young couple, working class couple, and they go and do all right. Reg gets ill, loses his job. They lose their home. The temporary accommodation doesn't work out. The family splits up. And it ends up with Kathy literally on the streets. With her children being taken off her by social services, and she screams out as the credits roll, "You're not having my kids, you're not having my kids." And that's the reaction I had then. And I've watched it twice in my life, once when I was 14 and once when I was 46, as I was about to meet Ken Loach on the 50th anniversary of the making of the film in the first place. That broke my heart. But I was angry as well. The sadness about Kathy's plight. And by the way, we lived in a two up, two down, my mum and my sister and me. Only a year or so earlier, a family had moved in with us, friends of my mum, for nearly a year in similar circumstances. And I thought that was great fun. Two more kids in the house. Brilliant. And it was watching Kathy come home made me think, oh, flip, that's what we were sparing my mum's friend and family from experiencing. Kathy looked like my mum. Anyway, at the end of all this, there was no internet, there's no emails to send at the end of it all or anything to click on. There was, however, an invitation to send a stamped address envelope if you were interested to hear more. I ended up joining Shelter. So I amassed 3 weeks' pocket money, which was £1.50. And I went down the post office the next day and bought a postal order. I'll tell you more about that later, kids, of what one is. I sent off, and I'd have bought a Smith single with that normally. But I joined Shelter, and that was my I was politicised by that. Yeah. And I guess by 1986, I decided you've got to pick a team. I picked the Liberals, basically because I'm an awkward kid. The Tories were in power. Labour were the lead and established party in Lancashire. I liked the cut of the jib of people like Shirley Williams and David Steele, and I decided to join the Liberals.
Great. We're interweaving the story of you as a politician, but also you as a Christian. So, not a church-going family.
No.
How did you end up believing in Jesus? How did that happen?
So, my mum, did a wonderful thing. Really, she went back to university when she was. I was in my early teens, and ended up becoming a lecturer at what is now the University of Central Lancashire, but was then Preston Poly. And just shortly before my A-levels, sort of March, in my A-level year, I came home one day to say that she and some other colleagues were going to be seconded to a college in Singapore. Now, I'd only been
probably
abroad.
Probably quite a few Singaporeans in the room.
So Singaporeans here?
Yeah, they won't
no.
shout.
No,
they
no,
won't
they're
shout.
All,
no,
okay. So
there's
quietly. Not.
Okay.
No, there are. Maybe there are. Okay, well, hello. So we went there, and my mum was teaching there. There's a bunch of other people from Preston Poly seconded from the business studies department. And I and my mum and my sister and a friend of the family who also was a lecturer at the college were given this house by the college. The house was just slightly, it was a decent sized house, but there was only 3 bedrooms. And so we had a bit of a scuffle as to who, got the box room, and it was me. Because I was leaving first to get my A-level results. It was perfectly nice room. It was just full of the junk that the previous tenants, who were also college lecturers, had left behind. In good order. It was they just happened to move somewhere else. So we moved everything out of that room for me to be able to sleep in it, except the books. And these guys were Christians. And so I read a whole bunch of, basically I got there and, I listened to music, I went out, I enjoyed the city. We lived in a place called Bukit Timah, which those of you from Singapore will know. And it was a bit like, a bit like Surbiton, really. it was kind of, lots of detached and semis. It was a very a nice, quiet part of Singapore, not too heavily concentrated.
So but driven to reading.
I was driven to reading by utter total boredom. I'd run out of music. I had loads of music, but, I still wanted to read things. In the end, I ended up reading stuff that you would probably call apologetics or interested about prophecy. I read a lot about Daniel. I didn't mean to. I saw this God stuff on the shelves, and a lot of it I was totally put off by. I reread all the Winnie the Pooh on the shelves before I got to the God stuff, because I was not reading that stuff. I had a really good friend at sixth form called Jack, who was the college Christian, he got pilloried for it. He was a lovely guy, really lovely guy. Everybody liked Jack, but everybody thought his faith was, I thought his faith was weird, restrictive and unattractive, and probably not true. That was my stance towards Christianity, and so I didn't really want to read those sort of books. In the end, I did. And to cut a long story short, it hit me with an almost physical force. Oh, flip, it's true. And if it's true, I joined a political party because I broadly agreed with its manifesto, with what it stands for, with the feel of it and all the rest of it. Christianity, it's not like you read the Sermon on the Mount thinking, I'll agree with most of that, so I'll join that organisation. I mean, if it's true, nothing else matters. Nothing is even close to mattering.
And that was a surprise. So we've called tonight, I imagine, a God who wasn't real. Yeah. You just thought God was not there.
Yeah. I mean, I wouldn't have called myself an atheist. My grandparents were officially Church of England, therefore, obviously, I was a Christian. I would have. What did I think of Jesus? I thought that he probably existed, and what we knew about him was probably unreliable, and that he was a good teacher. And I think that's the one thing you can't think about him. I know that's going over the trilemma that C.S. Lewis so beautifully presented, but when you examine what Jesus said, it's impossible to just think he was a good... can't just be a good, interesting teacher. He is either spinning you a web of lies, or he's a madman, or he's who he says he is. And the fourth option, by the way, some people come up with, which probably I would have opted for, is that he's legendary. That does not bear scrutiny. You know, if you are under the impression that what we know about Jesus is legendary, and he probably was a great guy, but what he said is just, you know, mythical and lost in the depths of time, I'm sorry, you need to have a word with yourself. That is not intellectually credible.
Because of the history.
Because of the earliness of the records. You know, it's not a case of, oh, the church has embellished it over time. When we've got fragments of the New Testament, written within the lifetime of people who wrote the New Testament, it's just not myths are only possible if there's times for them to go forward. It's only possible for us to believe that something was embellished if you haven't got the originals. We've just about got the originals. So yeah, churches and people who claim to be Christians have embellished over time and taken away or added to the gospel. But we can go back to the original pretty much and know that what Jesus said is what he said there. And frankly, it's either the most colossal and impressive hoax in all history, or it's true. And if it's true, you need to respond to it. Now, I might know that the 555 bus from Kendal gets me to Grasmere. I know that. I intellectually accept that. It is of no use to me whatsoever if I don't get on the bus to Grasmere. And the same applies. So you can intellectually accept, okay, Jesus is who he said he is. You still need to get on the bus.
And you did that in Singapore or soon after?
In Singapore, and I didn't meet another Christian, to the best of my knowledge, for a couple of months after that.
Until you arrive at university.
University, yeah. So the perfect scenario for me to completely fall away straight away. I came home from university, spent time with my mates, who I was in a terrible band with, we're still mates, and you'll be massively relieved to hear that we're not playing anymore. I was full on with them. I'd become a Christian, why I was a Christian. And with your very good mates, that stuff's quite easy because it's just another wacky thing. You know, wacky Tim's got another wacky thing that he's into, and it's another thing to talk about, added to football, girls and pop music and all that. I went to university in Newcastle back end of September 1988, and I've been there a few hours. And there's a knock on the door from what it turned out to be my next door neighbour in my hall of residence, a guy called Pete, who was a second year medic, a Christian. He could have had no idea that I was a Christian, and asked me what I want to go to the Navigators, which is obviously a brand sort of kind of Christian Union type thing that evening. And I did. I was church from then on.
So you had a good time as a Christian at university, lots of Christian friends, but you'd say the 9 years after university, you stop being a Christian, turn your back on it.
Yeah, look,
to a degree.
I won't say it was plain sailing for the 4 years that I was at university. I made plenty of mistakes, but I sought to be faithful. Left university and continued to be for a period of time, and then fell away. Let's be blunt, for the same reason that lots of young men fall away. And that lasted best part of 10 years.
And what brought you back?
I remember the thought process that did. So I was married by this time, and I was on a holiday with my wife Rosie and my two daughters. The boys weren't born at that point. So amongst the other things, I'm a serial nerd. I'm obsessive with about loads of things. And by the way, being a nerd is a brilliant thing. Being a nerd means you're so into something you stop giving a monkey's what anybody else thinks about you. Nerds are the best. And I am nerdy about lots of things, and also about space. I'm nerdy about space. So one of my great heroes is Carl Sagan, who sadly is no longer with us. That kind of microwave on wheels on Mars that was brought back to life in the Martian with Matt Damon, that's a real thing. It's on the surface of Mars, and it's now renamed the Carl Sagan Memorial Station. When I was about 10, he did a television series called Cosmos, and there's a book alongside it. It was a really human exploration of the exploration and discovery of things in space. I bought the book before I went on holiday when I was 32 and thought, because I loved the programme, I love Carl Sagan, I was going to read this book on holiday. And there was a regular refrain throughout the book, about how Christianity in particular, religion in general, but Christianity in particular, holds humanity back and is a nefarious influence. And the penny you dropped with me, if that's the right way of putting it, I didn't agree with Carl Sagan.
Even though he was your great hero.
He was my great hero, yeah. But I didn't agree with him on this. I hadn't stopped living as a Christian because, like Carl Sagan, I disagree with Christianity. I stopped living as a Christian because it was inconvenient. It was inconvenient. And so my backsliding was completely and totally intellectually, and in every other way, bankrupt. And so I won't say I there and then that night got down on my knees, but at some point in the following couple of weeks when I returned to the UK, I did. And by God's grace, I keep going. And that's what we are challenged to do as Christians, keep going.
And you just say what your wife said when you told her you were going back to being a Christian.
She thought I'd join some weird cult, yeah. Which I said, well, I'm already in the Liberal Democrat, so. But seriously, it was troubling. So she knew about, you know, my Christian background, so to speak, when we started going out with each other. But by the grace of God, she became a Christian in the years after, not immediately by any stretch of the imagination. But it was a tricky thing. But all is well.
Thank you. We're going to move back in a sort of politics direction. And I just want to ask you a brief question about success. Because I
know nothing about that.
Well, no,
I have, however, observed it. Go ahead.
this is the thing I wanted to ask you, because I think what you've just said is slightly your reputation, but actually you've been very successful. You've been president of the party, you've been leader of the party. You overturned a safe seat age 35. You won it again with an enormous majority 5 years later. Didn't you win an award as MP, local MP kind of thing?
I was already a councillor when I was elected, and I stayed on the council.
And I've heard you described as saving the Liberal Democrat Party. That was the sort of, that was the goal. So after the coalition, everything was in trouble. You were about the only MP left, and... were you the only MP left that hadn't voted for tuition fees?
Was that... No, I think it was probably four of the eight of us who were left.
You doubled the membership. I remember a friend of mine was working in the membership office at the time, coming back sort of pleased that every day there were new people pouring in. Mm. How do you think about success, and does it bother you that people don't sort of recognise your success?
Well, look, I mean, somebody once said, and I'm not sure who, but it's a great quote, that politics is showbiz for ugly people. C.S. Lewis said that pride is the great sin. And I think in many ways it is. And I think vanity is, you know, I think a temptation for all of us, I think especially in politics. So if I'm being honest with you, of course you want to be thought well of and to have been considered, you know, on the balance sheet of things, to have done well and all the rest of it. But I think it probably, because of my faith, I think matters to me less than it would matter to other people. I think in terms of, the leadership of the party, I mean, I think that it struck me that the eight of us who survived the annihilation of 2015 had no automatic right to expect that, you know, there would be a revival, and as the Tory Labour Party might be about to find out, we have no, political parties are synthetic, they have no automatic right to exist, and they don't necessarily exist forever. And so we might well, rather than being the kind of foothills for a new, climb to the top, we may have been just the last eight survivors hanging onto the funnel of the Titanic, about to go and join our mates in the icy depths anytime soon. So I think survival was not a given. And it struck me that two things we needed was credibility and clarity. And credibility means you've got to build your way back up, you start winning elections again. And clarity, which is about that as well, you've got to pick a message and be very clear about it. Absolutely. I mean, I think if you're on 30% in the polls, you can maybe afford nuance. If you're on 4%, it's a dirty word. You know, don't be blancmange, you've got to be Marmite. I chose to be Marmite. I mean, it was not a fake position. It was something I passionately believed. I think Britain is better off in the European Union, so people need to fight that corner. I totally respect people who take the other point of view, of course, but my view was that we had to be incredibly clear. And yes, that doubled the party's membership. And so, the local elections a couple of weeks ago saw us with our best result for, you know, well, I mean, in terms of gains since the party was founded in 1988, after the merger between the Liberals and the SDP. So there's been success in that sense, and you know, and I'm pleased with that. But I think I feel massively blessed to have the opportunity to be somebody who's a former leader. I don't really have great ambitions now.
I was going to ask because the current leader's older than you. You could go again.
I've already got one T-shirt. Why would I want to? and so I can. You've heard it here first. I'm not running for the Lib Dem leadership. Having said that, I'm not giving up. I love being a member of Parliament. I love being a backbencher. I love being, to be honest with you, I love being an MP for a constituency, the one I live in. It's the opportunity to serve people, make a difference, surprise people by being better than people think MPs are. So I love what I do. And I also love the opportunity to do this kind of thing more because, you know, if the cat fits, wear it. If I'm known as being that God botherer, then fine. Let's be that God botherer. And let's use the fact that I am, you know, moderately well known and have a platform to talk about my faith and try to just encourage people in this sceptical age and in this age of great, you know, tumult to just look again at the gospel. And I accept that there's an awful lot more to it than they thought, that it is far more rational and reasonable than they probably thought. And it is genuinely all the hopes that the world is offering us clearly have let us down, wherever you're coming from. And here's something that 100% won't let you down. I can tell you that in the years that I've sought to follow Jesus, I've been let down by many Christians, just as I, as a Christian, will have let down many people as well. I've not once been let down by Jesus, not once.
And I was going to ask, I wanted you to talk about Jesus, and particularly through the lens of leadership. And we're a little bit later on, we're going to look at a part of Mark's Gospel where Jesus talks about leadership. And my trailer for tonight was that I was going to ask you, have you come across any Christ-like leaders in your time in the House of Commons?
I mean, so I think that, you know, when you look at leadership, I guess you want people who are going to be willing to lead from the front and not expect others to do for them what they won't do for themselves. I certainly think that in the Bible, there are some great examples to us of leadership. I think as we obviously Christ-likeness is what we ultimately seek and even are promised. But I think we'll look at those who are not Jesus, but still hugely significant examples. I'm thinking of Daniel. And if you don't fully know the story of Daniel, this is a man who was essentially kidnapped from his society, taken as a slave to another one, but kind of rose to being probably prime minister, certainly being a very senior government official under the king. And, you know, people will know about the story of Daniel in the lion's den, but perhaps overlook the fact that in all probability, he served dutifully for decades without obvious incident. And he served. He served faithfully. He was therefore, I assume, a competent leader. And so just basically doing your job and being competent is really, really important. And so maybe as Christians, we look at Daniel in the lion's den and think martyrdom's what it's all about. Well, you know, it's a serious maybe dare I say it, a privileged thing if that is what is to befall you, to become a martyr. But don't go seeking martyrdom. Seek to serve God in the place God has put you. I think that you know, there are many, you know, good leaders I see out there, and I think there's strong characteristics in leaders of all parties that I've seen. And I think that Theresa May and Jeremy Corbyn, I'm sure I could pick out some strengths as well as weaknesses there. And it's important not to see people as in black and white terms. But I think Jesus is a leader.
And what's different about Jesus?
Well, look, I mean, I talked about credibility and clarity. Two things about Jesus. We go to clarity first. I think something we can be tempted to believe, and even, you know, Christians can kind of believe that this sometimes, is to think that somehow the Bible's kind of indecipherable, a bit muddled, it's a bit unclear, it's a collection of not connected stories. Actually, if you look at the gospel, if you look at Jesus' claims, and please do, you know, it's just worth, if there's a 1% chance that what I believe is right, you owe yourself an evening to read through Mark's gospel. Just, that's the only thing I'd ask of you. But if you were to read any of the gospels, and you see Jesus making utterly clear claims about who he is and what our response to him must be, and why, you know, forgiveness is only available through him, why forgiveness is the thing we need more than the air that we breathe, and that only he can offer it for us. So his message is utterly clear. He is unique, he is exclusive, he is God, he is the Saviour, the only Saviour. But he's also credible. And why is he credible? Because he died and he rose again. Fundamentally, if the resurrection happened, there is a God and Jesus is God. And all the other debates you might have over whether a God is there or not, what kind of God, that's all irrelevant. If the resurrection happened, Jesus is the Son of God, there is a God. Forget everything else. And so he has that credibility because he went before us. He also has the credibility of being the one who suffered in our place, who endured God's righteous and just wrath at human wickedness. He took it on himself despite being spotless and perfect. He went through pain that we cannot imagine for us. So you know that he loves you, because he wouldn't do that if he didn't love you. And you know that he's God because he rose 3 days later. So clarity and credibility. So he is, ergo, the greatest leader there ever was.
And can I push you personally on that? So what has been your experience of being forgiven by Jesus because he's the Saviour, because he died?
Well, multiple. I mean, walking away from him for several years. I mean, there's a story about a guy who became a Christian at 80, and in his baptism he was asked by the pastor to say something about his newfound faith and how glorious he felt. And he just said, "My life's been wasted. My life's been wasted. I've wasted 80 years, or how many years he'd been an adult, and, you know, opportunities to serve God." And so there was a great sense that I'd wasted a decade. And God forgave me that. But certainly, you know, as leader, when you come under the spotlight and you are questioned, as I found, about my faith and what it meant, and to the extent that it became a distraction to me doing my job and, you know, presenting the party's message, you know, undoubtedly I you know, did things that I should not have done, or said things that didn't honour God, frankly, in order to, you know, for reasons of convenience. And during the election, I felt a colossal sense of, you know, conviction. Indeed, made my decision to resign during the election. Then I parked it and thought, get on with the job, lead the party, do that afterwards, you know, step down afterwards. My pastor, Paul Baxendale, who was a wonderful support to me during that time, as he still is, I was on the phone to him one day, and he just said, "Look, Tim, for the Christian, sin spoils our relationship with God, but it doesn't end it. It doesn't end it." And hearing that was...
And that's when you're feeling that you've let Jesus down, you're feeling...
Yeah. So let's just remember, you know, we're often challenged, you know, be a Peter, don't be a Judas, you know, don't, you know, you let Jesus down, but don't turn your back on him, don't walk away from him. But I think the thing about Jesus, and again, this has only followed in recent times in my understanding, if you know the story, Peter denies Jesus 3 times, and then Jesus looks at him, and Peter realizes he has, as Jesus predicted, let Jesus down, denied Jesus. And then Peter breaks down in tears. He doesn't break down in tears because he's broken some rule. He doesn't break down in tears because he's transgressed some philosophy or some ideology. He breaks down in tears because he's let down a person, his friend.
And how does knowing about the death of Jesus help with... If somebody here tonight is in the same situation, what would you say to them about the
death of Jesus? So look, I mean, what Jesus cried out from the cross, amongst other things, was, "It is finished." So if you think there is anything you've done, said, or thought that is unforgivable,
you are telling Jesus that he wasn't big enough to die for your sins. It is finished means exactly that. It means everything you have done, said, or thought that has let God down or let your neighbour down, every selfish, wicked, appalling thing you've ever done, said, or thought or wanted, has been paid for once and for all. You're not 99% forgiven, you're 100% forgiven. So I just want to encourage you to think about your life and remember that however despicable you may consider yourself to be, you are 100% forgivable in the eyes of God through what Jesus did for you. So his death for you was a once and for all. It doesn't need to be repeated. And there is nothing that you have done or can do if you're following Jesus that will stop him loving you or nullify his death for you. His message is utterly clear and it is completely and totally wonderful. Yes, it's challenging. Living for Jesus is inconvenient, but it's glorious as well. And I just want to invite you just to take that seriously. And as I say, I might be talking a load of old nonsense. I won't use the word that's on the front page of the Liberal Democrat Manifesto. good Anglo-Saxon, though I believe it to be. I might be talking a load of old nonsense. But there might be a 1% chance, surely, there's got to be at least a 1% chance that I'm not. You owe yourself. Just, you know, I reckon it'd take you an hour and a half to read this. Read this. Think about it. That's all I ask of you. Because if it's true, nothing else matters. Not even Brexit.
You heard it here. Tim, thank you very much. We're going to pause there. We can keep talking to you, but thank you so much. Good. Could I ask you, please, to look round this way and to pick up those Mark's Gospels that Tim referred to earlier. And if you would turn to page 29. To page 29 in those Mark's Gospels. And we're going to look at Jesus' own words, and in particular his words about leadership that Tim sort of hinted at earlier, what Jesus does for those he leads and what he thinks about leadership. So if you're on page 29, you'll see where it says the request of James and John. Which means, just to give you the background, we're opening with a scene sort of taken from the Tory leadership campaign. Or actually, James and John, they're brothers. So actually this is two Milibands, I think, that we're with. So page 29, and let me read you their opening question in verse 35. And James and John, the sons of Zebedee, came up to Jesus and said to him, "Teacher, we want you to do for us whatever we ask of you." I don't, Tim, do you get those kind of leading questions? He said yes. Jesus is not fooled, says, "What do you want me to do?" They said, verse 37, "Grant us to sit, one at your right hand and one at your left in glory." And Jesus is never going to say yes to that, but he kind of tests them. Can you do what you need to on the way? Verse 38. And I think they don't have a clue what he's just asked them, but they know they're in a negotiation. So verse 39, they say, "We are able." They've just agreed they're willing to die for him, though they don't know that. Jesus says, "You will suffer, but I can't give you those seats." And is that the end of the story? Well, no, if you look down at verse 41, because there are 10 other disciples. And when they heard it, turn the page, they began to be indignant at James and John. Why are they cross? Because they didn't think of it first. That's why. They're no different. That's the consistent picture all the way through. Leadership then, same as leadership now. They want to be the best. They want to be in charge. And so Jesus then begins a discussion about leadership. And just like Tim says, if you're willing to give us that 1% benefit of the doubt tonight. So Tim discovered that Jesus was real, that what we're saying tonight is true through history, through the background. This is not a legend. Well, in that case, the person we're about to hear from in these words is the leader of the universe, certainly of the country, of the planet, is the leader of all human beings through all of time. And he's about to tell us what it is to be a real leader. So that's first point, real leader. And he talks a bit about normal leadership, verse 42. You know that those who are considered rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and their great ones exercise authority over them. And Tim was a bit too nice to get the knife out really too much into colleagues of his and tell us how that is. But you know it, don't you? Normal leadership, whether that is at your work or in politics or in arts or whatever it is, your sports team, this is universal. The people who are in charge, they lord it over the people who are underneath them. And yet, we all recognize sacrificial leadership when we see it. We recognize it's what's needed, and we recognize it when we see it. And it's interesting, Tim mentioned, so the Christ-like leader, I don't know whether on election night you were meant to say this, but the Christ-like leaders in the House of Commons, Jeremy Corbyn and Theresa May. And partly that's the sacrifice, isn't it? You can see what it's cost them. In, you know, Theresa May, you visibly see and hear what it has cost her. Well, Jesus, verse 43, calls leaders to be servants, verse 43, and slaves, verse 44. Whoever would be first among you must be slave of all. And before you think that is just unrealistic, well, he then shows that it is possible by talking about himself and then living out what he says. So verse 45, we must do that, for even the Son of Man, that's himself, came not to be served but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many. And to get the difference between what Jesus is talking about and even the most sacrificial human leaders, I think we need to do two things. We need to scale up who we're talking about, and we need to scale down, if you like, what it is that he did. So to scale up, what I mean is that Jesus is greater than Theresa May. It is true of his popularity. He was mobbed everywhere he went. He could have overthrown the Romans just like that. It's true of his power in what he said, his wisdom, his advice, his teaching that people still, even if they don't believe in God at all, still follow today. His healings that he was able to do everywhere that he went, and his electrifying control of every situation. But far more than that, and this is what we talked about on Sunday if you were here, those who met him see demonstrated in him that he is God with God's control over the world around us. We looked on Sunday at an incident where he tells a life-threatening storm to shut up and lie down. He has that sort of authority. He can raise the dead, even if the corpse is rotten. He speaks and the corpse comes out to see him. And in Bible terms, that means that Jesus is the one that created everything, who owns everything, and who sustains everything. Meaning that if he stopped concentrating, this building, these towers, your body would fall apart. You need Jesus to sustain existence. Which, put that back into this verse, verse 45 there. Anybody that he serves is someone that he made in the first place, that he owns, and that he has to keep going by concentrating on them. It's something he owns. I don't know, even the most house-proud person here, would you die for something that you own? Would you die for your sofa? Jesus came into this world to die for people that he made. And that's scaling up. Then scale down as well. The sacrifice of normal leadership does not get close to what Jesus is talking about here. Theresa May still has the Welsh mountains to go and walk in. Jeremy Corbyn still has his allotment. However things go, whenever they step down as leader, have you turned the phone back on? Do we still have a prime minister? Who knows? But Jesus, just turn back a page and you'll see that he knows exactly what this is going to involve for him. If you turn back to page 29, and let me pick it up at verse 33. Jesus said, "See, we are going up to Jerusalem, and the Son of Man," that's himself, "will be delivered over to the chief priests," so that's betrayal, "and scribes, and they will condemn him to death and deliver him over to the Gentiles. And they will mock him and spit on him and flog him and kill him. And after 3 days, he will rise." The closest I've ever come to being punched in this building was when I was attempting to get a group of students to take this seriously, to understand it. And because with students I feel slightly freer, though I am going to try and do it again with you tonight, we'll see whether a member of Her Majesty's Parliament can tolerate this. But I used the Queen as an example, Her Majesty the Queen. And I said, imagine a royal visit to St. Helens that went the way that Jesus's royal visit to the earth went. So imagine, Her Majesty the Queen very graciously consented to come to St. Helens Bishopsgate on the 22nd of May for a royal visit, and she arrived. And I began imagining the Queen doing a sort of series of menial and degrading jobs instead of, you know, shaking hands and saying, "What do you do?" That she was going around doing other things. And there was one student who was a trainee officer in the British Army, was looking increasingly uncomfortable, big lad. And it was the point where I said, imagine the Queen, instead of being in here talking to us, was outside sweeping the street with a brush made from her own hair. That was the point when he really, I did think he was going to just take me down, bustle me into the street. So I should say, I have a deep, instinctive monarchist. So I'm a monarchist, so deep instinctive feeling, huge respect for the servant-hearted attitude of our Queen, which comes from, she would say, this verse in the Bible that we're looking at tonight. She is trying to be like Jesus in how she treats other people. But my point was, it comes nowhere near to what Jesus Christ did. One this great comes down that low, and you think about it, the hands of the people flogging him and the very spit that they're launching at him, he's the one who has to keep it in existence. He could stop this at any second. He is that powerful, and he chooses to do it. That's what it means for him to be a leader. And very briefly, the implication of that, before we move on, the implication of that is this is who we're inviting you to follow. And this is who we're recommending. Someone utterly consistent, as Tim said, utterly loving. Someone who told us to turn the other cheek and then, as they're doing that to him, prayed, "Father, forgive them." There is nothing in the cost of being a Christian that he has not lived through, at least or worse, himself. But it could all be just a grand, futile gesture, couldn't it? Tim said that the mark of leadership is to be clear, clarity of mission. And Jesus says in one of the other Gospels, the Son of Man came to seek the lost. It says in Mark, came to seek, to call sinners. And if that's his mission, which probably you'd agree is bigger than doubling the membership of the Lib Dems, that's the goal of his mission. That was what he thinks we need. That's what we talked about last night. If you want to catch up on that, the recording's on the website, that Jesus thinks every single person in here, good or bad, needs his rescue. That is what this leader thinks he does for you. So real leadership, we've said already. Second thing, real forgiveness. Let me read verse 45 again. For even the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many. And there's a very simple idea in there that I want to unpack for us. And it is so simple that I've often found people misunderstand it. So simple, so easy, if you like, for us, for you and for me, that we just, a switch goes in the brain. We think it can't be like that. But let me try and explain it. Ransom, as in his death is a ransom payment. Sadly, ransom is still big business, isn't it, in parts of the world. It's a very straightforward setup. Somebody is trapped, a victim is trapped, and here that is you and me, trapped in our sin and our guilt and God's anger with what we've done wrong. And then a payment is made. That's how ransom works, isn't it? a payment is made and you go free. But instead of a suitcase full of banknotes, in this case, it is a suitcase full of blood, a suitcase full of the death of Jesus Christ, which is not what we normally mean by a sacrificial leader, is it? That's become a reduced category. We are talking about a sacrifice in the proper Old Testament sense of the word. There is sacrificial language all over this in the cup and the baptism. A few pages later, if you were to take this away and read it, Jesus is identifying himself as the Passover lamb, the sacrifice. And at its simplest, what's going on here is a swap, or an offer of a swap, a sacrifice. One animal in place of the guilty party. One Jesus in place of the guilty party. And last night, if you were here, I issued a challenge that if you think you're a good person, it's been about 24 hours since then, to see if you could do it for 24 hours, to live the way that Jesus says you should, which is to love your neighbor as yourself and to love God with all your heart and mind and soul and strength, and for your thoughts from the very inside of you outwards to always be pure and honorable and never covetous and deceitful and lustful and angry. And this verse here, this conversation Jesus is having with his disciples, it comes after the moment of greatest despair in Mark's gospel, which if you decided to have a go at my challenge over the last 24 hours, maybe how you've arrived tonight, and why I was particularly glad that Tim said some of the things he said towards the end. Again, just turn back a page. You'll see chapter 10, verse 26 on page 28. And the disciples have met a man who in their eyes is the most moral man in existence, and he goes away unforgiven, unacceptable. And the disciples, verse 26, say, "Then who can be saved?" And Jesus looked at them and said, "With man, it is impossible." Nobody can make themselves good enough. Nobody can deal with, pay for themselves, the things that separate them from God. And we're in suspense for only 20 verses, but we're in suspense until the verse we're on tonight and the ransom payment. And again, I say it's a simple idea. I want to try and put it to you as simply as possible. So I'm going to go back to my childhood and show you how it was shown to me. Well, it was shown to me with two video tapes, but I've tried to bring this up to our childhood. So I've got two DVDs, which I know is still not acceptable. It's still far too old-fashioned. But I've got One to Be Jesus, which I've gone with Die Hard. Again, to fit the right, you know, milieu, and One to Be Us, which is the Truman Show I've gone for. So again, we're deep back decades ago. And if the Truman Show fits, because here's a guy who, if you don't know the film, spent his life being recorded, his every action and word and deed. And what I want you to imagine is that instead of a sort of moderately interesting old film on here, instead imagine I've got the film of your life doing that. So imagine we've got every deed and every word in your life. And there'd be some wonderful things, some good things. But then imagine I've got the DVD commentary as well, where we can hear what you were thinking all the time those events were happening. So even the good things, actually, we can hear what's going on in your head. And I don't know about you, but we've got, you know, technology to show things on screen. If we had my life in a case like this, that would not leave my hand. So there'd be no chance of Mike or anyone else sticking that on for you to see. And there'd be things in there we all wouldn't want other people to know, certainly wouldn't want to show up to a perfect, holy God with. But in Jesus' account, there would be a life that is, again, the word is consistent, that he always did what he said you should. And his words, his deeds, his thoughts, they would always be excellent and brave and kind and compassionate every single moment. And then the way this was shown to me, which helped me a lot, was just, and I'm not sure I can do it without dropping a CD, but is that on the cross, Jesus says, "I will swap records with you, swap places." So let me try and do that. So Jesus's account comes out, and mine does as well. And it is as simple as switching them over. I haven't dropped one yet. Here we go. Get it in there. And we swap them over so that when Jesus goes to the cross, what God sees is what I've done wrong, what the whole world has done wrong. Everything that we've done that hurts God, that God is angry with, that hurts other people. And Jesus on the cross is punished fully for everything that we did. And this is why Tim said that in Jesus there is 100% forgiveness. No doubt at all. Because everything I did, everything I continue to do wrong is in here and is being punished on Jesus. And in my life, instead of the things I really do and say and think, instead of that, there is this astonishing life that is always brave and kind and good and caring and truthful and consistent. And when God looks at me, that is the life that he sees, because Jesus said he would swap places with us. Now, I wonder if you see why I said that might be too simple, too easy to get hold of. Just look down at the verse again and let me draw out a few final implications as we finish. First implication there, what a leader. Again, is this not the most successful, bravest, most wonderful example of leadership you ever heard of or seen? Tim talked about leaders who lead from the front. But he decided, even though we had turned our backs on him and rebelled against him, he decided to lead us out of that problem by taking off us everything we'd done wrong and dying for it and bearing the punishment. That'd be one implication. Second implication is, again, to underline the encouragement Tim gave you, to take this very, very seriously. There are good reasons to think that Jesus is God, good reasons to think that he is right about your heart and my heart and our need for forgiveness, that we should not let ourselves stand before God after death with our own record hanging over us. And in terms of what we'd need to do about that, Tim's suggested it to us and illustrated it with what he did. It was explained to me clearest as a sort of ABC, three letters that stand for three things it would be good to say to Jesus, say to God. And one of them is really what we talked about last night, A for admit. And that I personally found the hardest bit of this to do, to admit to Jesus that his description of me as a sinful person who needs his rescue, that that's true. There's no way forward unless you admit that. Admit. B is what I guess we've been majoring on tonight, is B for believe it, meaning trust this offer from Jesus. The suitcase full of his blood is ready. The ransom payment is ready. And you could trust him, believe him. There are good reasons to do that, to commit yourself to him and believe him. And then C, we'll talk about a bit more tomorrow if you can come back. C is C for commit. And again, Tim talked about a period in his life when the inconvenience of following Jesus overrode the knowledge that it was true. And that would be an experience echoed around the room, I'm sure. But to follow Jesus is to say, I admit I'm sinful, I believe in your offer, and I commit myself to following you no matter what the cost. And I'm going to pause there and just say one or two other things by way of announcements, but I would suggest you take away these Mark's Gospels, maybe write down ABC in them, and think very seriously about saying those things to Jesus when you come to think they're true.